Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, and welcome to the Ghibliotech, the podcast that clambers through the cupboard of films from the world's greatest animation studio, Studio Ghibli. I'm Michael Leader, and I've seen a lot of them.
And I'm Jake Cunningham, and I'm taking very small steps in catching up.
So join us on our quest into the glorious world of Ghibli. So, Jake, this is our 11th episode so far, but our 10th film in the Studio Ghibli canon, Arrietty. You've passed a decade now.
Double digits. I made it. Yeah. I'm on my way to becoming a real man.
A real live boy.
Yeah.
Any observations as we go?
It's so interesting to just see both the development of my reactions to the films as we kind of move past the big hitters into the ones that maybe are filling in the biggest gaps for me, because I was already kind of aware of the role and influence of some of the films like A Grave of the Fireflies or A Spirited Away, whereas something like what we're talking about today, Arrietty, was, I know it's a big release and it made a lot of money, but for me, it never had any social impact at all. Like, no one ever really spoke to me about it, didn't know much of the imagery or anything like that. And that's really what we're at the stage at in the show now. And we're really filling in those empty spaces. And arguably, that's maybe the most exciting bit because it's in a whole brave new world.
Yes, we're digging into some would say the smaller scale films. And in this case, that's literally accurate. This is Arrietty, the borrower Arrietty, the secret world of Arrietty in some territories. Jake, are you ready?
I'm so ready.
Arrietty is a young girl who lives with her family of tiny borrowers who reside under the floorboards and in between the walls of a country house. They forage for food and supplies by making daily excursions into the house, all the while staying out of human sight. But when a teenage boy comes to the house to rest before an operation on his heart, an unlikely bond forms between human and borrower, bringing new excitement and new dangers into the lives of Arrietty and her family. The question remains, can these two households live side by side in peace?
Now, Michael, we've spoken before about Ghibli's inspirations from kind of classical European texts and traditional English fairy tales, that kind of feeling. And The Burrows is very much that story to me. Like, this is almost a Sunday afternoon BBC family-friendly special.
Yeah, literally so.
Yeah.
And in the 90s was a Hollywood movie with John Goodman, yeah.
And I'm really fascinated to know how Ghibli ended up doing a borrower's story.
Well, it's interesting. Miyazaki and Takahata loved Mary Norton's original book decades before this film was made. But that was back before they had the clout to make adaptations. And this is something, as we go on, you'll notice. This is around the time where suddenly Ghibli make a lot of adaptations of English language British works. We've had Howl's Moving Castle already. He follows with Arrietty. Then we also have Tales from Earthsea. And then When Marnie Was There. These are all books from the English language literary canon or young adult canon. And he's scratching that itch now that maybe he didn't have previously. But let's set some context. After the huge success of Ponyo in 2008, 2009, Miyazaki approaches producer Toshio Suzuki with a plan. He says, I have a five-year plan, which involves stepping back from the director's role and into more of a planning producer role and letting two younger filmmakers from the studio stable to take on feature film directing duties. And these projects would be From Up on Poppy Hill, which would eventually be directed by Miyazaki's son, Goro. But then there's also Arrietty. And the complication there was who would they have to direct? And Toshio Suzuki immediately recommends Hiromasa Yonebayashi, who's a name we'll come back to time and again. But back then, he was just an animator. He joined the studio for Spirited Away. He remembers that the very first frames that he animated were part of the opening scenes of Spirited Away, the dad at the food market shoveling spring rolls into his mouth. But Yonebayashi's definitely a sort of Ghibli lifer at this stage. He said that when he was at college, the film that changed his life was Whisper of the Heart.
Right.
And that informed everything he wanted to do going on.
I wonder after Hosoda's exit from Howl's Moving Castle and that experiment was bringing in an outsider to the studio, now they felt maybe a bit safer if they were going to have a new director come in. It had to be someone who knew the studio.
Exactly. He was very popular with the staff. He had a nickname, Marrow, that lasts to this day. But there's a funny story here. I think, and you mentioned Hosoda and this behind the scenes tussling of rattling of sabers and butting of heads between the older and younger generations. How Hosoda left the project because he said that Hosoda left Howl's Moving Castle because he said that they wanted him to just make a Miyazaki movie. That's not what he wanted to do. Whereas, is Yonebayashi a safe pair of hands? Well, not necessarily in Miyazaki's mind. Miyazaki was a bit baffled by the suggestion. Yonebayashi is almost an unambitious filmmaker at this stage, an animator. He had no intentions to direct. Suzuki and Miyazaki had to convince him to take it on board. And there's a very revealing interview with Miyazaki on the DVD for Arrietty. This is a promotional interview that I think reveals something of the atmosphere and culture of Ghibli at the time.
A promotional interview that's meant to be selling the film.
It's an extra on the disc that was made. I think the film is still in production at this point, so it's right up front. But it's Miyazaki sitting in front of a bookcase and next to a massive Totoro doll in Toshio Suzuki's office, chain smoking. And he says, he's in a gloomy mood. He says, I had envisaged that we'd produce a lot of new talent, people who were ambitious and had an inexhaustible supply of ideas, but we haven't. So we assigned the job to Marrow, who just stood there vacantly. This is, as I said, promotional interview. Miyazaki's always looking off screen at the end of every sentence at Suzuki, who I think is sitting at his desk just off camera.
Everyone recording that must just be hoping that that's a joke.
Well, this is the thing.
What is the atmosphere in the room?
Let me quote a few more parts of this into you, because this really, really shocked me. There's a whole sequence where of the interview where Miyazaki says, he's a good guy, but that alone won't produce a good film. There's no use flattering him, as you can see. He's not suited to dealing with the public. We'd rather hide him away, not let him wander around. And at the end of all these things, he does kind of have a pause and then laugh and then look off camera at Suzuki and says, am I being too honest? But there's a whole second sequence where he just criticizes Yonebayashi already for how he's dealing with the interview that he's just recorded for this disc. Very bizarre. And on the flip side, in Yonebayashi's interview, he was asked about his relationship with Miyazaki. And he said when he first started working on Spirited Away, working at Ghibli, he was, in the same room as the great Miyazaki, this great filmmaker. But he was soon put in his place. He was called over by Miyazaki and given a dressing down, given an earful, at which point Yonebayashi says he almost burst into tears right in front of him. He recalls a day when he turned up in shorts and sandals in the summer months for the office, and Miyazaki came over and pointed to him and said, why do we hire him? And there's a segment of the interview which is Yonebayashi's memories of working with Miyazaki. And Yonebayashi has this 1,000-yard stare where he says, as for memorable instance with Miyazaki, I don't have many good memories. So this probably gives you a taste of that.
Why did they decide this guy was the one for the job when seemingly none of them like him?
I think they like him, but it's just this ribbing. Maybe there's something being lost here in translation. Mm. It's part of the intergenerational father-son banter. I mean, literal, when we come to Goro Miyazaki's films, it's even worse. But this is just the first step for Yonobayashi. He's clearly well regarded by Miyazaki and Suzuki because he makes another film a couple of years down the line when Marnie was
like
there.
It's like a Ghibli version of Hazing.
Yeah, exactly. But there's a great quote from Yonobayashi. He says that Miyazaki's words can pierce you right through to the heart. Maybe not the best boss.
No.
Great filmmaker, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, Arrietty's finished, released in July 2010, and it's a box office hit, but not to the heights of a Miyazaki movie. Reportedly, over 1 million people went to see it opening weekend, and it landed in third position at the Japanese box office for that year. Just behind two Disney movies, in fact, Alice in Wonderland and Toy Story 3, which curiously has a cameo from a Totoro
in it,
which is an interesting way of Miyazaki one-upping Yonobayashi there, maybe. but in a unique turn of events, it comes out in the UK first, July 2011. Stuart Canal and Optimum Releasing put a lot behind this one. But it gets a bigger push in America in February 2012. It's retitled the sequel The Secret World of Arrietty and given a bit of a Disney sheen on the promotional materials and is released in over 1,500 cinemas.
Which is, like, that's huge numbers. Like, Spirited Away was, what, like 20, 30 screens?
Yeah, Ghibli films before that had never been released on more than 36 screens in a single weekend, so to go from that to 1,500. I mean, Ponyo had a larger scale release, but this was, you know, by far the largest to date. And as a result, it makes just shy of $20 million in the States, which is to date the highest grossing Ghibli film in the United States, beyond any Miyazaki movie. So at least on the international stage, Yonobayashi beats Miyazaki.
Yeah, it's really interesting stuff. I'm certainly excited to hear a lot or delve into the reactions to Arrietty because, I mean, it went big on release, but the whole thing, for me, felt small scale for Ghibli.
Exactly. Let's see what you made of it, Jake.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
So, Jake, we have covered a film before directed by someone not Miyazaki or Takahata. That was Whisper of the Heart. But this is a new generation coming to Studio Ghibli. Hiromasa Yonobayashi's first film. Did you notice anything different? Anything surprise you?
It's a funny one because of the story behind it. It was like, when I was watching it, I was constantly thinking, right, what's the same and what's different? How is this person trying to make their own mark? And how are they mimicking what's come before them? And I think there are a lot of similarities to other Ghibli works or what people like myself as a more casual viewer might easily recognize as a Ghibli film. And it's extremely relaxed in pace. It's relatively quiet. And at the start, we're in a country house. It's quite overgrown. There's green lawns. Very Totoro-y type way. We've got someone who is ill and they're taken to the country to get the clean air and feel better. We've got a young girl on a bit of an adventure, making a big step in her role in the world, and a lot of familiar territory. But in a way, I also felt that it was like, I mean, there's going to be so many puns in this one, in this episode, but it is almost a bit too small.
Yes.
I felt like the big joke of The Borrowers or any film like this, or Honey, I Shrunk the Kids or something, it's all to do with scale, and there's a lot of sight gags in there, or being creative with what can you do with a small person in a big world.
Mm.
And actually, that felt a bit underused.
Mm-hmm.
At the start, I thought, oh, this is really neat, that they're not just going in with an Ant-Man. They're not just going, here is a small thing next to a big thing.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that great? And that's the obvious joke. And I thought, oh, they're building a world first before we start playing around with that. And we'll actually see the family's house and we'll just get little bits of background information that show us how this world has been built. We've got the lid of a fountain pen. It's a vase. We've got a little thimble as a lamp. And I thought that was all really nice, but ultimately the integration with the wider world didn't feel exploited enough. I thought there was actually missing a bit of fun.
I see this film as almost being in search of a plot. Even then, writing that plot synopsis or reading it out, that's not really the film. There's only one real moment of action, and that's at the end when the family have to move away. Everything else is so much mood and so much sense of discovery and exploration.
Yeah.
I wonder whether this gets to the heart of something that's different about Miyazaki and Yonebayashi. Yonebayashi is a very emotional filmmaker. This generation gap between the two, where Miyazaki was looking at children and saying, I want to create a character for them. Yonebayashi think, you know, it has a closer affinity to his character.
He's in his 30s when making this.
Late 30s, yeah. So he's, you know, in the grand scheme of things, into the Japanese film industry, a very young guy. But he's, so there's this melancholy emotional texture all the way through about, you know, tortured teenage souls and unattainable romance, but, you know, this star-crossed lovers that just by a sense of size and scale, they could never be together. And I think Yonebayashi sees himself in that role, in that character. He is Arietti, or he is the boy, the teenage boy. We'll see this more with When Marnie Was There. And about this sense of the style, Toshio Suzuki says something very interesting in his memoirs, where he says that Yonebayashi is a better stage manager than director. If a director like Miyazaki is somebody who stamps their personality and point of view on every frame of the movie, Yonebayashi is more like a stage manager who allows every other craftsmen to do the job well.
Yeah, there was not a lot here that made it feel like stylistically distinct from some of the other works I've seen. There are a few bits that I really liked, like something that didn't shock me, but was a really nice surprise in the earlier moments of the film, is how it works with focus.
Yeah.
Something that I hadn't even thought about with the other works that we've watched is how they use the depth of field and how shallow a frame might be. And it's a simple thing to use on a film like this, where you are involving a lot of scale. So if you can rack focus from someone in the distance who is big, and then pull in to a leaf or a piece of grass, and then put a small person on that leaf, it has a lot of impact for something quite small. And that's really nice, that you are getting huge impact from a relatively simple thing. And I think maybe that was Yonebayashi's objective here. Like, how can we do something that has that is a big world, but in a very small way, quite literally?
Exactly. And he was so interested. He says he was, as I said earlier, he was reluctant to take on this project, but Miyazaki and Suzuki gave him the novel and said, read the novel, come back to us and tell us what you think. And he was at the time invigilating the entrance exams for the new class of Ghibli animators. And while he was invigilating, he was reading the book, and immediately he was just entranced by how to make this world work. The idea of, as you say, a thimble being, you know, being a normal sized receptacle in this world, or having a house where you see a rolling landscape outside the window, but it's actually a postcard that's been placed just outside a frame. And that's what excited him, the idea of a small person in this big world. And you can see that these sequences, there's that first borrowing sequence where Arietti and her father go out. And
I think is a really great scene. This is perhaps the most foreboding I've known the studio ever to be. You mentioned the emo Yonebayashi. Yeah, totally here. It's almost a dirge at times. Like, it's quite adventurous, and we've got nails that have been bashed into a wall, and it's almost like a level from the Crystal Maze or mixed with the Mines of Moria.
Yeah, yeah.
And I really loved that, and I loved actual tension, which I'm not used to feeling with watching this, but there was no payoff of that tension. And that was the thing that I felt was missing from the film, that what that scene leads to is them seeing the boy, and then that was it. And I just felt after all that build-up, and you almost teased with the, with, again, going back to the, this idea of scale and how can we play the large with the big, it's like you're waiting for a punchline the whole time that's not quite there, or they don't integrate.
Well, there's no sense of stakes in this movie. But one thing it does have that Miyazaki movies don't have is, I think, an outright villain. Maybe the first villain we've touched on in this in this podcast is Haru, the maid.
Yeah.
Before we dive into her, I want to point out that the voice of Haru in the Japanese language version of the film is by Kieran Kiki, who's this great actress who passed away this year. She's seen in many Hirokazu Koreeda films, six in fact. Most recently, in her final film, Shoplifters, which won the Cannes prize this year, and as we're recording, is in UK cinemas just coming up. So the fact that she's there is giving. She's got this incredible old lady voice. She's a very good, sort of kindly, slightly sinister old lady in many films, with a bit of an edge to her, and she brings that to this role where she is an actual antagonistic figure who, for some reason that isn't really clear, really wants to get rid of the borrowers from the house.
Yeah, and we're getting this mixed execution of, in one way, we're wanting to make a film with no conflict and no plot, and we have seen that work before. And I'm listeners might think I'm contradicting myself with what I enjoy about these films, that I'll say, oh, I love the second half of Howl's Moving Castle
because it chilled out.
Yeah, or I love Totoro because of exactly that reason. But perhaps it's the contrast in Ariety that we're being presented with an idea in one way, but then we're also being presented with a villain who is meant to instigate that conflict. And the two parts don't quite work together. And she, for me, as you say, has no reason to hate them so much. Mm-hmm. And because it's not believable, you ultimately don't warm to her in any way, which you need to do with a villain to actually get some empathy for them to balance out the story.
Mm-hmm. It does give rise to a second key scene for me, which is this brilliant sequence going back to Yonobayashi as a sort of stage manager. It's a very well executed sequence where you're in the borrower's house and the mum is pottering around and the roof is ripped off. And it's actually the boy.
Yeah.
And he's doing a very kind thing of bringing them the kitchen from the doll's house, this amazing tricked out kitchen that the borrower mum has always wanted. And it's seen from the borrower's point of view, where it's almost this kaiju movie, where this huge monster is messing with their business. And then you see that scene play out, and then it almost has a mirrored effect where you go from Haru's point of view, where she finds where the borrowers are in that cupboard and the floorboards. But then you see it from her point of view as she rips off the roof once more and sees the tiny borrower just shivering away in fear, tries to run and immediately gets scooped up in her hand. And that's such a well choreographed scene. This is something that's a very well animated sequence and film in general.
Much like the ladder on the nail ladder, first borrowing that I mentioned earlier, that's where you're getting a real sense of fear in these two scenes. And I think maybe we could have done with a bit more of that. But as you said, that's one of the moments where it's really working the scale for you. Like, I think the kaiju point is exactly right. You feel like we're somehow in a tiny portion of a Ghibli Michael Bay film something.
Yeah, that could be. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But as I say, there's this sense of Yonobayashi as a great animator, but not quite there as a storyteller yet. A couple of key minor characters are so well animated. I think we've talked about Ghibli cats before, but the cat in this film is like none we've seen. The fact that it's shaped almost like the cat in Whisper of the Heart. It's this big brown ball with a grumpy, tired eyes, But you're talking about Monster Movie. When we're first introduced to the cat and it's bounding across the garden and trying to get through the grate into the cellar, it's a proper monstrous, you know, antagonistic force.
Yeah.
But then the cat gets redeemed at the end.
Oh, of course. If it's Ghibli, they've got to redeem the cat.
Exactly.
The cat's got to be the hero in some way. I would just like to quickly mention something that I really liked about it was, and it's quite a simple way of working with that idea of scale and size, was how the sound design worked in the film. And there are bits where they're trying to steal a sugar cube, and in the background there's a grandfather clock going. And that could just be sitting in the background, or you could amp up the tension by using the score, but they just use that clock and really reverb it up. And you can't help but not notice it. And we're almost in a Mission Impossible zone.
Yes.
And you have this replacement of the natural sound effects of different objects. Like Arietti has a pin that she keeps in her...
She almost like a makeshift scabbard that she makes out of her dress.
Yes.
Yeah.
But then when she wields that, it's as if it is a medieval sword or something. And there's lots of little tricks of sound that I think
Well, you mentioned
really
the sound design. When the first moment, and this is where we get back to Imo Yanobayashi, the intensity of a youthful romance that he gets in a way that the older filmmakers maybe don't. There's that sequence where Arietti is trying to come in from the outside into the boy's bedroom through the window, this little gap in the window. And is it a crow or a blackbird is trying to eat her? And he jumps up and he tries and he moves the bird out of the way, but there's this little moment where his hand just touches Arietti and the sound just disappears. And it's being touched by the boy that I fancy is this great moment in the film. And you can see that he's thinking on that level rather than a didactic level or even a political, socio-political level that Miyazaki looks at. I think this is something... Yanobayashi is almost a victim of Stockholm syndrome when it comes to Ghibli. We talked about Hosoda, Mamoru Hosoda, about when we talked about Howl's Moving Castle and how he had to go elsewhere, and he's made an incredible career for himself where his films are only his films. Whereas Yanobayashi is still making what we've called in the past Jukebox Ghibli.
Yeah,
movies.
It totally feels like maybe Hosoda was meant to come in, fall in line, here's how you make the films. And he was not that guy. Whereas here, if we just hand over the blueprints, this is how you do it. These are the things that you need to tick off.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately leaves something missing.
Yeah. And that is still right through to today. Yanobayashi, in the period where Ghibli closed down production after When Marnie Was There is released, Yanobayashi and Nishimura, one of the other producers, go and form their own company called Studio Ponots, and they made a movie called Mary and the Witch's Flower, which is, in terms of the look, the aesthetic, the feel, the animation, the greatest Miyazaki movie Miyazaki never made. And it's packed with, it's the greatest hits. And it's so interesting to hear him speak about that fractious relationship with Miyazaki, whether it's a joke or not, because he's still making films within that shadow. And this is where it all starts.
And where this film ends seems to be actually the end of the first act.
Yes, exactly. You look at other Miyazaki movies, you know, Spirited Away, we've not got to Kiki's Delivery Service yet, but it's always about these girls going on an adventure, going out into the world, finding themselves. And that's where Arietti finishes with her. It's actually the closing credits where you see her and Spiller, her new rough boyfriend, potentially, going off down the canal.
Yeah. Which, it was like a nice ending to look at. I do have to ask you about the music. Where did that come from? Because it's horrid. I mean, I don't know much about it, but some of these songs, they're like 10 a.m. slot on a Glastonbury alternate stage.
Well, it's the first score that we've covered and in the Ghibli history that was created by someone not Japanese. It's Cécile Corbel, who is a French Breton singer, very much soaked in that Celtic folky world. She loved the movies. She loved Ghibli, and she sent a mixtape to Toshio Suzuki, in fact, and he really responded to it and just thought, why not?
And why not? What?
Well, there's, it sounds like you know why not. Yeah. You have a reason why not. And so it didn't really work for you, did it?
No, it didn't. But I got to see how this one worked for you, Michael. I think it's time to put this film on our leaderboard. So now it's that moment where we ask Michael Leader to rank these films. Our list is getting ever longer. This is number 10, but is it going to be number 10 on the list, Michael?
It is going to be number 10 on the list, Jake.
Cruel.
So this is now bumping Howl's Moving Castle up a slot. So just in the top 10 still. Will it stay in the top 10 for longer?
Just in the top 10 out of 10.
But I must say, we've talked in the past about Tears. If I was giving this a star rating, this would still be 3 out of 5. We're still far from bad movies. Mm-hmm. Will we ever see any bad movies in the next 10 films, Jake, is the question.
I mean, as we know, you started me at the top tier. This show's only going to get worse, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But that's it for today. We hope you've enjoyed your time in the Ghibliotheque. Next week, The Cat Returns.
Another film by a different filmmaker.
Mm.
A sequel. This is our first sequel. It's a pseudo-sequel spin-off from The Whisper of the Heart, which is number one on the leaderboard, isn't it? So, high anticipation for this one, Jake. But before we go, we just want to say thank you to Silk Factory, who helped us make the show.
Yep, we're lucky enough to be sat in their studio in Soho right now recording this. But they don't just make podcasts like ours.
They also make content for TV, digital and social platforms, and trailers too.
Yep, go and check out their work at thesilkfactory.co.
And that just about wraps things up. Until next time, you can follow Jake on Twitter at Jake H. Cunningham.
And you can follow Michael at Michael J. Leader.
Ghibliotheque is a Little Dot Studios production. We record at Silk Factory. Our music is made by Anthony Ng, our artwork is by Sophie Moe, and Steph Watts helps us out with all of our GIFs, images, and anything else we post online. The show is produced by Michael Leader, Jake Cunningham, Steph Watts, and Harold McShiel. That's me. I do the voiceover for the credits as well.
Hi everyone, thank you for sticking with us through the credits. We have listeners from all over the shop, so I thought it would be a good little tidbit to point out that Arrietty is the only Ghibli film with both an American and a British dub. If you're over in the States, you might not realise that we have a great English language version over here with the likes of Saoirse Ronan, Mark Strong, Olivia Colman, and future Spider-Man Tom Holland in his very first on-screen role. I'd say that's worth checking out if you want to listen to the dubs.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.